The Guardian.
On the right, facing the thrones, sit the commons. On the left, the lords. Behind the speaker walk men who perform the office of speaker in the several parliaments of the Commonwealth. By their presence, they pay tribute to the mother of parliaments, to whom their own governments owe birth.
Because I wanted the world to get better, and I knew it couldn't get better if it's going to be ruled by men. As a matter of fact, I think it's amazing how well the men did for 2,000 years, considering they tried to do it alone.
December the 1st marks 100 years since the first woman took her seat in Parliament. That day was one of huge importance, but there's a part of this story that has been left out of most of the history books. On the 1st of December 1919, two women journalists were allowed into the press gallery for the first time. I can only imagine the nerves and excitement of being the first women journalists in Parliament. I wanted to learn more about them, but that wasn't easy. In hindsight, it's obvious that it was a momentous occasion, but it seems the historians in the early 20th century didn't agree. So I went on a mission to find out more about these women. Along the way, I spoke to some of the women I consider to be the trailblazers in Westminster, politicians and journalists alike.
There was almost an assumption that the men did it and we had what was left over. But we didn't question it at the time.
It's not just about doing those women a favour, letting them into the press gallery. They are a democratic imperative because without them, we only see half the world.
I'm Kate Proctor, political correspondent for The Guardian. And in this week's Politics Weekly special, I look back at the last 100 years of women, and specifically women journalists working in Westminster.
Mrs. Emmeline Pankhurst carried the fight to the masses as head of the English movement. On more than one occasion, she was arrested for overzealous demonstrations on behalf of the universal women's suffrage.
Before we get to 1919, I need to go back to 1890. When women were fighting for the right to vote, women journalists were also arguing for their spot in the press gallery. A woman, recorded only as Miss Blaine, applied for a place in the press gallery on behalf of the Women's Penny Paper, which was an early suffrage newspaper. A parliamentary officer refused, apparently remarking that male journalists would much resent their intrusion. In 1918, the first female MP, Constance Markovich, was elected for Sinn Féin, but like all Sinn Féin MPs, she chose not to take her seat. Which brings us to 1919.
She once said that pioneers are picturesque figures, but they're also often lonely ones. And I think that was very much her experience, because for almost 2 years, she was the only woman in Westminster. And I think at times, that was very difficult.
This is Rachel Reeves, Labour MP for Leeds West, quoting Nancy Astor, the first woman to take a seat in Parliament on December the 1st, 1919. Rachel wrote a book called Women of Westminster, The MPs Who Changed Politics. In it, she tells the story of how Viscountess Astor was elected in November of that year.
So Nancy Astor was in some ways an accidental MP because she had no intentions of standing for Parliament. Her husband was the Member of Parliament for Plymouth Sutton and his father was Lord Astor. And when Lord Astor died suddenly, his seat in the House of Lords passed to his eldest son, and his eldest son was Nancy Astor's husband. Now, Waldorf Astor, her husband, didn't want to be in the House of Lords. He wanted to be an MP in the House of Commons. And so he planned to relinquish his seat in the Lords as quickly as possible and return as the Member of Parliament for Plymouth Sutton. And so he was looking for a stopgap candidate to keep Plymouth Sutton warm for his return. And so he asked his wife, Nancy, to stand for Parliament. Nancy was duly elected in November 1919 and served as the MP for Plymouth Sutton until 1945. So 26 years is quite a long stopgap. And of course, Waldorf Astor never returned to his seat. And that's how she became an MP. But it hadn't been something that she was seeking to do. But once she was there, she was there for more than a quarter of a century.
On the day Astor took her seat, the press gallery was packed with political journalists covering the day's events. Among the group of men sat two women, Marguerite Cody of the Daily News and E. Cohen. I haven't been able to find her first name, but her article was published in the Yorkshire Evening Post. Their invasion was short-lived, as they were only allowed in for that one day. But Nancy Astor stayed, much to the praise of women all over the UK. Rachel Reeves again.
Nancy Astor, when she was first elected, received 2,000 or 3,000 letters a week from women around the country. It's not just in her constituency in Plymouth, but from women in every corner of the United Kingdom, who regarded Nancy as their MP. And they wrote to her saying, you know, only you will understand what I'm going through. And they appealed to her as a woman, as a politician, but as a woman in that role.
By 1923, there were 7 women elected to Parliament. The next year, Stella Wolf Murray became the first female lobby correspondent. Part of her role was covering the women MPs and issues affecting women and children. Over the next couple of decades, the number of women MPs fluctuated through general elections and by-elections, as did the number of women journalists. Some editors took the view that it was not necessary for women to cover Parliament if there were not a huge amount of women there. In the 1940s, however, Patricia O'Brien joined the press gallery. Back then, there was accommodation for the men who covered late sittings in the House of Commons, but no such luxury was afforded to Miss O'Brien. So in order to get home, she had to catch the early morning fish train, or if she was lucky, the milk lorry. Oh, and she was also fired twice in the 1950s for getting pregnant. Despite the many roadblocks put in their way, women kept wanting to cover Parliament. And in 1974, Julia Langdon became a lobby correspondent for the Labour Weekly newspaper.
Hello.
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 Hi.
I'm Kate.
Hello,
nice
Kate.
To meet you.
Hello.
Thanks for having me over.
Oh, your dogs.
Come on.
I went to visit Julia in her West London home, where I was greeted by her two lovely West Highland Terriers. She explained what it was like to work as a lobby correspondent in the 1970s.
I left Labour Weekly in 1977 or 78 and joined The Guardian. And I was number two on The Guardian, and my friend Eleanor Goodman, who later joined Channel 4 News, which is better known, was the number two on the FT. And we were mistaken for each other everywhere we went because, you know, there's just one of those over there. It was extraordinary.
The woman.
Yeah. And people would come up, and an MP would come up and say, oh, here's this letter I was telling you about. And I would say, what letter? And he said, well, I was telling you about it yesterday. And I said, we didn't have a conversation yesterday. Were you by any chance talking to Eleanor? And that's what it was. We were just interchangeable because we were women. What really fixed it in my brain was when I left Labour Weekly to go to The Guardian, I took a man reporter round to show him what to do, a man called Martin Linton, who later became a Labour MP. And everybody made gender-related comments, as we would say these days. Otherwise, things like, oh, your legs aren't as good as hers, or, you know. And what was really interesting was at the end of the day, Martin said, I didn't realise you had to put up with all that stuff.
Julia wasn't fired for having children, like Patricia O'Brien was, but being a political correspondent wasn't easy when trying to raise a family.
My late husband was also a political correspondent. We had a nanny. I mean, we both travelled hugely, so you had to have someone living in at home. And you have to be paid enough to be able to afford to have full-time childcare, but you can't do the job. But it was difficult with my first child. I missed her first step and her first word and her first birthday. I can remember ringing up from Moscow with, I was at the Reagan-Gorbachev summit, I think, in Moscow for her first birthday. But, you know, it was all right. they made it through.
While Julia was busy covering the lobby in the 1970s, another woman was trying to rectify how unequal representation was in Parliament itself.
I didn't really decide I wanted to be a politician as such. I was part of the women's movement in the 1970s, and we used to meet in groups of women.
This is Harriet Harman, Labour MP for Camberwell and Peckham and the longest serving female politician in the House of Commons. Like Nancy Astor, Harriet remembers receiving lots of letters from women when she was first elected in 1982. There were many women writing to her, but as she explains, there weren't very many women writing about her at the time.
I remember when I first arrived in Parliament in the early 1980s, looking up from my place on the green benches to the press gallery, which was absolutely packed because there was no recording at that point. So it was the press gallery that reported to the outside world what was going on in Parliament, and it literally being all men. And for somebody who was, there was 97% men and only 3% women when I was in the House of Commons first of all. So basically, I was a very small minority, but in the country, it was 50% women and 50% men. And I felt very much that I was there on behalf of women to raise the issues that were simply ignored by politics and by Parliament. But looking up at the press gallery and knowing that these issues would be completely alien to them. They would have no interest of them in them, no experience of them, because they were all men. And what there was is a sort of self-serving cosiness between all the men up in the gallery and all the men on the green benches of the House of Commons. The agenda that I was putting forward, which came from the women's movement, about saying that a woman should not have to expect to be beaten by her husband, and if her husband was beating her, she was entitled to leave him, and that was not undermining the family. That was actually just justice for the woman, and that a woman shouldn't have to choose between having children but also going out to work and making something of herself in the world outside, that she ought to be able to do both, and that she ought to get equal pay. All of those issues were absolutely alien to the men in the gallery. And also, they regarded them as not proper politics. So that when I raised issues like childcare or holiday play schemes, they were like, what on earth is she talking about? She's supposed to be doing politics. That is not politics. She doesn't know what she's here for. You know, if I'd have been talking about the mines or the money supply or new motorways, that would have been fine. Talk about childcare and domestic violence, they just thought was not on the political agenda. The problem with that is that they were the means of communication to the outside world. So I remember there was one terrible column done by Keith Waterhouse in the Daily Mirror when I raised the issue of holiday play schemes for the summer holidays. And, you know, Keith Waterhouse did an absolutely excoriating column in the Daily Mirror saying, I didn't realise what I was supposed to be doing in politics. This was not a political issue. This was for women to look after their children. It was nothing to do with the public policy agenda, and that I'd got the wrong end of the stick. So when a woman would arrive in the press gallery, I would be like, thank God a woman's arrived. I would give every single possible story I could possibly give to her to try and help her find her feet and stay and be at least a voice for women.
One of the women Harriet might have been happy to see in the press gallery in the late 80s was journalist Carolyn Quinn, who was subsequently the first female chairman of the press gallery. I grabbed a chat with her in a very noisy office in the House of Commons.
I came here in 1989 at the very end of November, and I came as a local radio reporter working for the BBC. We had some offices in Bridge Street, which is where Portcullis House is now, with very old equipment. There was only about six or seven of us, but we were covering everything that local radio wanted. And basically, there was no televising of Parliament at that point. It was just coming in, which was why they'd recruited people like me to come in from the regions. So for the first couple of months I was here, we were working on radio and trying to guess the voices, because there were radio broadcasts from the Commons, but not televising. So I got quite adept at learning who sounded which way and what the accents were. But luckily, then televising of Parliament came in quite soon after that. It was an exciting time, but also, you know, it was quite a lot to take on as a young female reporter.
There's no thought of slowing down, because we've built a marvellous basis and we want to go on. and it's just going to be...
Caroline joined the BBC group of political reporters while Margaret Thatcher was still Prime Minister.
And at that point, it was full of big blokes, and I mean literally big blokes. Hugh Edwards, John Pienaar, John Sopel, John Sargent, Jeremy Vine started around the same time. So, you know, they were big characters. And at that point, there was one female political correspondent called Em Rudwin, who was there just slightly before me. I joined her, and it was us two really amongst the blokes. And again, in those days, there wasn't rolling news. There were the main bulletins, Radio 4 bulletins and the TV bulletins and the newspapers. That was what was covering Parliament. So you can imagine the battles to get on to those very few outlets when you come to being a BBC reporter. So the ladies had a bit of a fight to get on. And then luckily Five Live was introduced as a rolling radio station, which gave me and Emma bigger chances to get on. And then we started to move into doing the television pieces as well.
She didn't notice it at the time, but looking back, she sees that things weren't exactly equal between her and her male colleagues.
I didn't feel patronised, and I didn't feel that I was being demeaned or dismissed. But nevertheless, I think there was almost an assumption that the men did it and we had what was left over. But we didn't question it at the time. If I could go back now, I would probably challenge a lot more. But on the other hand, it was a good learning environment. You know, and sitting in those meetings and sitting among other correspondents, you know, who'd been around here a long time, it was a very good way of learning. Of course, it would have been nice if I'd been able to learn from a few more women as well.
After the break, we look at what it's like for women working in the press gallery now.
You sort of forget, I forget a little bit how I felt when I first came in here and you were meeting people who were the people that you looked up to. And I see it now when people come into the lobby. I mean, you forget because you get so ingrained in this place and it becomes normal. And sometimes you see new people and you think, I remember that feeling.
Welcome back to this special episode of Politics Weekly, celebrating 100 years of women in Westminster. I started working in the lobby in 2015 for the Yorkshire Post, and I think I was a little relieved and surprised at just how many women there were working there. Annabel Dixon, who works for Politico, took me under her wing and showed me the ropes, for which I'll be forever grateful. It was far from the all-boys club I had anticipated. A couple of years before I arrived, Kate McCann, who is now a political correspondent at Sky, was starting to make her way up the ranks. But as she tells me, and Caroline Quinn, she first had to figure out the layout to Parliament.
I think there is a sense here, because it's so steeped in history as a building, and because some of the ways that the lobby works are so archaic in a way, but they are defined by like a set of rules that no one gives you. So when you join here, you walk into this kind of maze of corridors and you don't know where you're supposed to go. I mean, even getting to the lobby briefing now, it's not in Downing Street anymore. It's in a room at the top of a turret in Parliament. No one tells you how to get there. And I joined with a paper called City AM, and I was the only political correspondent. So they gave me a pass and they set me off here and they said, you know, go and find the press gallery. You haven't got a desk or an office, but someone will help you. And I remember walking into the press gallery cafe, and I knew that the lobby briefing was at 11 o'clock in the morning, but I had absolutely no idea where. And I had to ask somebody. And I think part of the feeling of being here, you don't know anything. You don't know how to get to places. You can easily get lost. And, you know, I went into the briefing and it's got strict rules about you have to ask questions on a certain subject and you have to ask to change the subject. And, you know, it's not a free for all. It's quite strict in a way. And I didn't know that. So I sat there for at least sort of three or four lobby sessions, not asking anything. And then I thought, no, you know what, I will have a go. I don't remember feeling like I was the only woman, because I wasn't. We've got more senior women in bigger positions, which is great. I certainly felt like there were rules that I didn't understand. I felt like the people who understood those rules were the men, but that's by the design, really, of the fact that it takes about 10 years to become a political editor. We're still in a bit of a lag when it comes to who is going to be in that role. But the guys were perfectly nice to me. I remember when I was working on a different paper, someone said to me, not actually a member of staff from that paper, it was The Sun, someone else had said to me, oh, well, you're the new women and health correspondent, right? And I was like, sorry, what? Because I was the most junior member of the team, which was right at that time. I was really new. I hadn't really done this job before. And it's, you know, I was glad to be on a national paper. But they were like, oh, you'll be doing all of the, you know, stories about maternity leave and childcare. And I thought, what? That's not right, is it? And it wasn't like that. There was a bit of a feeling that, you know, maybe I might want to pick up some stories that might apply more to me than other people. But I think that was just, like Carolyn said, it was the way it had been done for a really long time. Mm. And I actually do think now there's a lot more opportunity to challenge. And it's become a bit of an in-joke in a way that makes it easier to say, hang on a minute, I'm not doing that. Do you know what, does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. But if I had known then what it would be like now, and the fact that, you know, so many women now are, you know, they're political editors or they're moving up the scale. The papers have now adapted to allow women to go have children and come back and actually work, which was a really difficult concept back then. I think there were very few women when I first started who were having children and then coming back to work. And now, I mean, it's still difficult, and the hours here, the paper deadlines, for instance, are, you know, still horrendous for family life. And the Commons hours, all right, they changed under Tony Blair, but, you know, they're still really quite rotten hours, aren't they? So it is not a conducive job to a family life. But I get the feeling that there is much more flexibility now and more understanding. Mm. Whereas I think when I started, it's not that they wouldn't have understood, but you just wouldn't have asked. You wouldn't have asked to go early because you had to pick up your kid.
I think there is still a feeling of, particularly when you're a young person, whether you're a female or male, when you join a place like this, you feel so lucky to be here. And I think there's something in the way that women think, certainly in the way that I thought and probably still do think, which is that I am lucky in a way to be here. There's something in me that says, you don't quite have the right to be here. You know, someone's going to find you out at some point and, like, you'll be out on your ear and you'll have to find another job.
Oh, the imposter syndrome. We all have that.
And I think that's something that is in more women than it is in men. And it's something that we basically have to be aware of and try and overcome. And I think in an industry like this where there are, you know, there are ways of doing things that have been like that for many years, it can feel a bit like you are trying to get into a club that you don't really belong in. And it's not because of the way that the men here think, because they all have, you know, many of them have daughters. They are very, very supportive of women. You know, I've had people have mentored me and helped me. John Pienaar from the BBC, Adam Bolton from Sky, you know, John Craig from Sky, Tom Newton-Dunn from The Sun. You know, these are guys who, it's not because they don't want it to happen. It's because they don't necessarily think about it in the same way that we do.
Carolyn believes that for the most part, being a woman hasn't affected the work that she's been able to do. But Kate remembers a not-so-distant past when being a woman was effectively an invisibility cloak.
There have been occasions where I have been in, you know, dinners, and it's pretty run-of-the-mill here to have a lunch partner, so that's another journalist from a different publication that you would go out with an MP for lunch or dinner, and you do that to share the cost, but also because you sort of share the story and it's easier with three people. I've been at dinners with my lunch partner, who is a male journalist, where the male MP or minister has only spoken to my male colleague. I remember one with a Conservative MP, even when I asked a question or made a point around the dinner table, he answered only to my lunch partner, directly into his eyes. And at the end of that lunch, my lunch partner, Harry Cole, got up and apologised to me on behalf of this other person.
Because he noticed it.
It was impossible not to. And he said, I felt so uncomfortable about what just happened. I'm so sorry. I tried to direct him back to you by saying, as Kate says, but even then it wasn't enough.
That says more about that individual.
Oh, very much so. But it's not usual.
Yeah, that's not
but
normal.
That has
it's
happened. That has happened. I've also had people say that some of my male contacts are only contacts of mine because they fancy me or because they want to go for a drink with me because they think that I might want to go out with them or date them. I've had people joke about the fact that I only get stories because I'm a girl, and I challenge it like we all would challenge it. And, you know, I think part of that is the competitive nature of this place. I think part of it is a hangover from days that have gone by, and that happens less and less.
The competitive nature of this place that Kate refers to there is hugely influential in how we all get treated in the lobby. As she explains, man or woman, this place takes no prisoners, and actually the anti-social hours and work-life balance conundrum is something that sneaks up on all reporters in Westminster.
I remember speaking to Chris Hope, was one of my colleagues at the Telegraph, you know, the most dedicated family man, one of the most dedicated family men I've ever met, you know, really struggles with trying to balance, getting to his, tries to go to all of his kids' dance and music performances and be there for his family all the time. He is in exactly the same position as women in the lobby are, who are trying to manage that. But it, for even for him, you know, for men, it was very difficult to say, you know, I need to leave now, I need to take time out. I've spoken to so many guys who feel that they can't say that. That's not just a woman thing. That's a product of the environment that we are in. And it's harder for women because we often bear more of the burden, if that's the way, maybe burden's the wrong word, but of trying to get home and sort it all out. But there are guys here too who feel, they feel the same way that we do. Yeah. It's no, there's no difference in that.
I get the impression though that there is much more thought going into to it now in terms of maternity, paternity, you know, parental leave, so much more thought going into it. Whereas in the past, it would have been assumed, I think, that the woman would just take on the childcare role, and we wouldn't have questioned it, which seems mad. And I know, and I almost hate myself for not having questioned it back then, but that's the way it was. And as Kate says, there were kind of ways of doing it. And possibly it was like that in other workplaces as well. But this is such a particular workplace because it's, we're so concentrated together, and it's so competitive. I haven't been lucky enough to have children. But, you know, the fact is that the demands are so great and the hours are heavy enough. And I find it difficult enough to organise myself. So I have nothing but admiration for my colleagues who are parents who can sort of organise their families and themselves, because I'm certainly failing sometimes to organise myself, especially during the election.
You can organise this for me. I had a child as well. How could I even be here?
I have to say, Carolyn, on that point about you wish you'd questioned it more, I don't want you to feel like that, because it's people like you being here and being in a senior position that made people like me think that I could do it. And I remember coming in and you being, you always have been so kind and like welcoming. But it's what Kate says, you know, there is a feeling here of people have your back. You know, I worked with Beth Rigby, Laura Koonsberg, when I got my new job at Sky, you know, said, if you've any got ever got any questions, you know, it's stuff like that, knowing that you've got someone there who is, who's done it, who knows, you've seen them do it, you can see it can be done, and I watch you and I think, right, well, okay, well, she can do it, so I can do it. So it's fine, I know I can do it. But for you, it would have been...
That's a great responsibility now.
No, but for you, you know, you were the one who blazed that trail. That was you doing
well,
it.
Well, after some great women before me as well. Yes, well, thank you. I mean, it's very good to know, but, you know, you always think you're sort of struggling against the tide, don't you? In whatever you're doing, not necessarily because of your gender, but just, I certainly don't feel I'm an inspiring person at all.
As you can hear, Kate and I are fans of Carolyn, who is a fan of pioneers like Julia Langdon and Eleanor Goodman, who came before her. But it's not just journalists who appreciate seeing people they relate to around the Commons. Rachel Reeves, the Labour MP who told the story of Nancy Astor at the beginning of the podcast, understands this idea of a sisterhood between all women in Parliament.
When I was first elected, I got to know women like Heather Stewart and Anushka Astana at the Guardian, Laura Koonsberg, Sophie Ridge at Sky, and all of them were sort of starting, really, their careers, and I was starting mine. But also, there were, and there are, a decent number of women political journalists who are starting their careers and working their way up in the newspapers at the same time, in the same way in which we're trying to work our way up the political ladder. And I don't think it's a big surprise that you do form relationships with people like you. And so, you know, I've got to know and become friendly with some of the women journalists, perhaps in a different way compared to my relationship with some of the male journalists. So I think it is really, really important for covering the issues that women are talking about in Parliament, to have women in the political lobby and in the press gallery. And I guess there are probably a lot of shared stories and parallels in our careers as politicians and the careers that women in the lobby face as well. But certainly we're here because this started 100 years ago. 100 years ago, there were no women in Parliament and there were no women in the lobby. We've made huge progress, but I think every generation finds that there are still inequalities still to right and ways in which we can work together to create a more equal society with more equal opportunities. And I'm certainly determined to do that.
Of course, when Julia Langdon was in the lobby, she often covered Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. Julia never felt a sisterhood bond between her and Thatcher, but she does believe that the Prime Minister related in some way to women reporters.
I remember, for example, we'd been going round the Temple of Karnak at Luxor, and we were back on the plane and she was complaining about her feet. And I said, well, you were wearing high heels. And she said, well, I have to wear high heels. It's all right for you. You don't have to wear high heels. So, you know, we would have conversations like that. And there was another trip. We were on a completely deadly itinerary. And I looked at it with a view to packing because we were away for 10 days. And it was one night in the Middle East, the next night on the plane, the next night in Singapore, the next night in Perth in Australia, the next night in Canberra, the next night in Melbourne, the next night in Sydney, the next night in Brisbane, and then two nights in Bangkok. And I looked at it and I thought, oh, not going to be able to do any laundry till Bangkok. And on the first leg of the plane, I said to Mrs. Thatcher, what do you think of the itinerary of the trip, Mrs. Thatcher? And she said, do you realise we're not going to be able to do any laundry till Bangkok? The horror of realising that I think the same thing as Mrs. Thatcher.
Julia must have felt somewhat comfortable with Thatcher, because towards the end of our conversation, I found out that she even performed for the Prime Minister.
We had a fantastic centenary of the lobby evening, and we did a cabaret, a group of us. Jim Nocte on the piano, the late Chris Potter of the Sun, David Walters, who was a political correspondent for ITN, Bill Russell, who wrote the scripts, Bill Russell of the Glasgow Herald, and Eleanor Goodman and I. And one of the songs we sang to the tune of Hello Dolly was Hello Bernard. Well, hello, Bernard. I have sung this song actually to Mrs. Thatcher on a plane somewhere.
You have?
I have, yes.
What did you make of that?
Well, everybody laughed. And she didn't get, there's one filthy line in it which she didn't get because she never got dirty jokes. But the first verse, I'll say it or I can sing it. Hello, Bernard. Well, hello, Bernard. It's so great to see you there at 4 o'clock. You're looking swell, Bernard. We can tell, Bernard, that the ladies had a fit. You're in a state of shock. We feel the room swaying and we're all praying that you'll lose your temper like you always do. So, this is Eleanor and me, hold the front page, fellas. Bernard's in a rage, fellas. That means we've got a front page lead for you.
Oh my God. You sang that to Margaret Thatcher?
Yes.
I didn't set out to have Julia Langdon sing on this podcast, but I'm pretty chuffed to have heard it. While making this podcast, I was quite conscious of not giving the impression that there are day-to-day burning injustices within the press gallery and lobby. That's not been my experience, and many of my inspirations in journalism are naturally the male editors that I've worked for. But I think it's only right to acknowledge the impact that women journalists have, and how important their perspective is in politics. Harriet Harman, the longest-serving female MP, puts it best.
It's not just about doing those women a favour, letting them into the press gallery. They are a democratic imperative, because without them, we only see half the world. We only have the world reported through men's eyes. And we need political reporting to go on through women's eyes as well, because the experience in this country of being a man and a woman is still a different experience. So we need a 360-degree view. And I'm pleased to see so many more women in the gallery. They're still outnumbered 2-1 by men, but I'm still urging them on.
My research for this podcast has taken me through over a century of wonderful women and their stories, from when Nancy Astor first took her seat all the way through to today. The one downside I come away with is the fact that there is such a gap in history where we should have heard about some of my peers from those first few decades. Here's what I did manage to find out. Stella Wolf Murray, who was the first female lobby correspondent, went on to run her own news agency, Women's News and Views. And aside from journalism, she was an aviation enthusiast. Patricia O'Brien, who was fired from the press gallery twice in the 1950s for being pregnant, became the first female parliamentary reporter for the Press Association. Marguerite Cody doesn't appear to have worked in the press gallery again after that first day in December 1919, but she built a career as a reporter, eventually becoming the editor of the Liberal Women's News. Unfortunately, when I went to look for more information on E. Cohen, I couldn't find anything. But my hope is that the various anecdotes recorded in this podcast will go some way in making sure that women in the lobby are remembered going forward. Julia Langdon told me that when she was given the opportunity to become a politician permanently, she had to decide whether or not she really wanted to enter politics. Instead, she says, she wanted to be the one who told the story, and I think a lot of us working in the lobby can relate to that. That's all for this special episode of Politics Weekly. Huge thanks to everybody who took part. It was produced by Danielle Stevens. I'm Kate Proctor. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.